Good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator. As we begin, may I remind you to silence cell phones or anything that might disrupt the presentation. We appreciate it. The library is able to offer events like this one, as well as buy books, read to kids, and maintain our building due to the generous support of our members and friends. Many of you probably just received an annual fund letter, and we'd love to hear from you in response. Information is also available at the front desk. So thank you. Tonight's speaker is our acclaimed library member writer, Pamela Newkirk. She's director of undergraduate studies in the New York University Journalism Faculty and the authors of Letters from Black America, A Love No Less, More Than Two Centuries of African-American Love Letters, and Within the Veil, Black Journalists, White Media. She was part of a Pulitzer Prize-winning team at New York's Newsday and has also written for the New York Times and the Washington Post, among many others. It's nothing but a pleasure to introduce Ms. Newkirk, but I struggle to find a word to say about her book, Spectacle. Not because it's a bad book. On the contrary, it's such an amazing book that it fills me with anger on behalf of its subject. And while anger may be useful in some contexts, it's not so great for an introduction. In frustration, I looked at the catalog listing for the book. Its subject headings include Pygmies, Crimes Against, United States, Social Life and Customs, 20th Century. Crimes Against, now that's a powerful and evocative phrase from the dispassionate Library of Congress. And followed right up with Social Life and Customs of the United States, kind of as if our national catalogers feel that, in this case, American customs were a crime. And the New York Times review suggests that Spectacle does all that can be done to redress that crime. It is, they say, a gripping and painstaking narrative that breaks new ground. Now, after a century, Ota Benga has finally been heard. Please join me in welcoming Pamela Newkirk.
Good evening, and thank you all. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, staff of the New York Society Library, and all of you who are here tonight, including friends, fellow members of the Library Book Committee, I think I saw a few of you, and fellow writers with whom I exchange little polite nods since we can't speak in this building. In fact, this may be one of the few times I'm allowed to speak out loud in this building. I always consider it a privilege to belong to this special community of readers and writers. It's an honor to be invited, especially so because so much of my work on this book was done in this beautiful building. And while the topic of my book, as Sarah indicated, is Ota Benga, tonight I'll focus my remarks on some of the unexpected issues that arose during the course of my research. So in 1906, Ota Benga, a 4 foot, 11 inch tall African from the Congo, was exhibited in the Bronx Zoo Monkey House, at times with an orangutan. The exhibition in one of the city's premier institutions inspired breathless headlines across New York City and eventually throughout the country and in Europe. And while the exhibit was viewed by 250,000 New Yorkers and chronicled in dozens of accounts and in the Zoological Society's own bulletin, and I should note that the New York Zoological Society is more commonly referred to us, those of us in New York, as the Bronx Zoo. And while this account was so chronicled in so many different accounts, 10 years later, the entire episode was dismissed as urban legend. The New York Times, which in 1906 had published more than a dozen articles on the exhibit, a decade later reported that Ota Benga had actually been employed by the zoo. As for the zoo, in its account, in 1974, it said it's unlikely that the exhibit had ever occurred at all. William Bridges, then the curator emeritus, in his book Gathering of Animals, An Unconventional History of the New York Zoological Society, explores the history of the zoo beginning with its creation in 1899. And in recounting the episode involving Oda Benga, Bridges rhetorically asks, and I quote, "Was Oda Benga exhibited like some strange, rare animal? That he was locked behind bars in a bear cage to be stared at during certain hours seems unlikely." He wrote this, of course, patently ignoring evidence in the Zoological Society archives that verified his daily exhibition in a cage at specific times of the day. Then, in the purported effort to clarify what had transpired, Bridges claimed that Benga had entered a cage to play with the chimpanzee that had accompanied him from Africa and, quote, "a label of information about him was hung on the front of the cage which he was in." He concluded, quote, "at this distance in time, that is about all that can be said for sure, except that it was all done with the best of intentions, for Oda Benga was interesting to the New York public that had not been privileged to see Verna's family of pygmies in St. Louis," a reference to the St. Louis World's Fair. Of course, Bridges had presided over the archives, which held voluminous records of Oda Benga's captivity, with dozens of letters between zoological officials divulging the daily exploits of Oda Benga and the men who caged him. Then in 1992 came the book Oda Benga, The Pygmy in the Zoo, co-authored by Philip Verner Bradford, the grandson of the African explorer who brought Oda Benga to the United States. The book was said to be the story of friendship between Samuel Verner and Oda Benga. The first few pages left me intrigued by the notion of friendship between them and how only one ended up on display in a monkey house. Still, in this retelling, Benga and Verner enjoyed a warm friendship, and in a story akin to Robinson Crusoe and his sidekick Friday, enjoyed wondrous adventures in the Congo. Verner's defense of the exhibit and the ruthless means by which he brought Oda Benga to the United States was not recounted. The narrative had no citations and was almost entirely based on Verner's uncorroborated accounts. The book was nonetheless named a New York Times notable book, as was mine 100 years later, and it inscribed Verner's tale of friendship with Oda Benga into the hard drive of history. And while I was astounded by the extent to which the episode had been revised and sanitized by elite guardians of history, my former dissertation advisor, the social theorist George Bond, who was also an anthropologist, would not be. In 1994, he wrote, "Representing the past is an expression and a source of power. Social constructions of the past are crucial elements in the process of domination, subjugation, resistance, and collusion," close quote. Oda Benga, of course, had no power. So for 100 years, his story had been fashioned by the very men who, during his lifetime, had callously exploited him and their heirs. The void of Benga's silence was filled by the narratives of the elite, which were widely circulated, uncontested, around the world. These unsubstantiated yet comforting tales found their way into books, on Wikipedia, and in hundreds of articles. These stories, filtered through a lens of race, power, and shame, were fashioned against the backdrop of a marginalized African who was rendered voiceless, defenseless, and without agency. Many apparently found little reason to find implausible the notion of friendship between an African explorer and a young man who was exhibited in a monkey house. This suspension of reason, this unquestioning acceptance of the accounts of the elite, resulted in a flourishing fiction, a historical fraud, to go unquestioned for a century. However, these narratives could not withstand the scrutiny of archival research or of reason. These accounts in the New York Times, the New York Zoological Society, or by the New York Zoological Society, and Verna himself defied any faithful reading of the archival record. Banga's exhibition, quote, in a bear cage to be stared at during certain hours, close quote, is unequivocally documented in newspaper articles, correspondence, and in the Zoological Society's own bulletin. These records illuminate glaring instances of conspiratorial silence, half-truths, and in some cases, flagrant deception, and raise troubling questions about what we know and what we think we know about our past. While Oda Benga did not leave behind personal papers, his humanity and acts of resistance can be gleaned in mountains of archival records, including letters, ship passenger records, Verna's autobiographical accounts, newspaper and magazine articles, anthropological field notes, records of the St. Louis World's Fair, census data, photographs, recorded recollections of those who knew Oda Benga, and the ephemera of the era. These documents enabled me to retrace Benga's footsteps from the Congo through Europe and across the United States. And what I discovered exceeded my worst suspicions about the relationship between Samuel Verna and Oda Benga. And in the process, I was able to see ever more clearly how the racial attitudes of New York City's social elite were embedded in scholarship, government policies, and in popular culture, and why it has been so difficult to dislodge those attitudes from the national psyche today. So first, a little about Samuel Verna. He was the first child of a slaveholding family in South Carolina who came of age during the virulent backlash against the gains blacks had made during Reconstruction. An avowed white supremacist, he went to the Congo first as a missionary and then as a man determined to make his fortune in a country that was being plundered by Belgian King Leopold II. As millions of Congolese were being enslaved, murdered, or maimed under the guise of civilizing them, Verna left his missionary post and focused his efforts on capitalizing on the tumult. In 1904, he returned to the Congo as a special agent for the St. Louis World's Fair, and he was commissioned to bring back so-called pygmies to exhibit at the fair. Fair organizers hoped to map human progress from the lowest to the highest civilizations with so-called pygmies, the diminutive people of Central Africa who lived in the forests, defined the least civilized. In an extensive shopping list, Verna was to bring back, and I will quote directly his list, one pygmy patriarch or chief, one adult woman, preferably his wife, two infants of women in the expedition, and four more pygmies, preferably adult but young, but including a priestess and a priest or medicine doctor, preferably old. Can't make this up. Heavily armed and with the approval of Belgian King Leopold II and U.S. government officials, he went hunting for pygmies, and Benga was the first of his captives, about whom he wrote an article for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch entitled, How I Hunted Pygmies in the Congo. In lectures and articles, Verna promoted Oda Benga as a cannibal, noting his pointed teeth, which in reality were fashionable across the Congo. 2 years later, Verna temporarily turned Benga over to the Bronx Zoo, where he was exhibited in the Monkey House in September of 1906. Quote, Bushman shares a cage with Bronx Park apes, was the headline in the New York Times on September 9th, 1906. Tens of thousands of New Yorkers flocked to the zoo to see Bangor as he silently sat in stupefied silence. Ministers' protests fell on deaf ears. Mayor McClellan refused to meet with them. Zoological officials refused to intervene. The zoo director, William Hornaday, then the nation's most eminent zoologist and also the founding director and co-founder of the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., he was defiant, saying that the exhibit would go on just as the sign said, each afternoon in September. Oda Benga, he insisted, quote, had the best room in the monkey house, close quote. Let you sit with that for a minute. New York Times editors could not understand the uproar. Quote, we do not quite understand all the emotions which others are expressing in this matter. Oda Benga, according to our information, is a normal specimen of his race or tribe with a brain as much developed as are those of its other members. Whether they are held to be illustrations of arrested development and really closer to the anthropoid apes than the other African savages, or whether they are viewed as the degenerate descendants of ordinary Negroes, they are of equal interest to the student of ethnology and can be studied with profit. Close quote. In the end, it was Bangor's resistance to captivity that ultimately led to zoo officials turning him over. He was entrusted to the care of Reverend James Gordon at the Howard Colored Orphanage in Brooklyn's Weeksville section. And so my book recounts Bangor's brief stay in Brooklyn, his journey to Lynchburg, Virginia, and his return to the Howard Colored Orphanage farm in Long Island, where he lived a lonely life in St. James. Perhaps most importantly, it places Oda Benga and his humanity in the forefront of a story set in a turbulent era for Black Americans, North and South. By reasserting him into a story previously framed solely by the elite, we are afforded an unromanticized version of history, one that neither lionizes him nor assumes his complicity in his own degradation. Spectacle is just one example of a counter-narrative forged from overlooked historical records and underscores the need for a higher level of skepticism when recalling our turbulent past. And I will leave it there because I'm sure you have questions about Oda Benga. Thank you. Yes, that was the point of sending him to Lynchburg to a theological seminary. So he was taken into that community where he did attend classes for some time. One of his teachers turned out to be Ann Spencer, who went on to become one of the most famous poets during the Harlem Renaissance. Yes, hi.
Two questions. Is it true that he committed suicide?
Quite true. She wants to know if it's true that he committed suicide. Spoiler alert, yes, he did. He was in Lynchburg. It was 10 years after the zoo exhibit. Well, yes, it depends on the age that you believe he was. My theory, if you look at the book jacket, he looked like a kid when he was exhibited at the zoo. He later in life told people that he was about 13 years old when he was captured in the Congo, which would have made him about 15 when he was at the zoo and then 25 when he died.
And secondly, what led you to take on this project? And how long?
A Okay, first, what led me to it is kind of a complicated story, but I was interested in this period and looking at the history of really looking at race in New York City at the turn of the century. So much had been written about, you know, the turbulent times in the South, and so little had been written about what was going on in a city, a world-class city like New York. And I thought this episode offered a window into the times. And what I found was not what I expected to find, of course. I could not have imagined that there was this wide web of complicity that allowed this exhibit to go on. My understanding was that it was like some, you know, one zoo director who just had a bad idea. But then I discovered that it wasn't just seen as a bad idea, it was seen as science. And then I leaned in even more. And initially I didn't want to do this particular story because I just thought an African in a monkey house seemed the worst kind of stereotype, and I didn't want to play a part in perpetuating that. But then once I saw the voluminous documents that were available, and also the level of deception, that's what really sparked my interest in this story. About 4 years of research. Thank you. Yes.
Was there a comment in the African American press at the time, or African American leaders in the city?
Yes, well, African American leaders were the ministers who mounted a pretty much a daily protest against the exhibit. But I have to say that the first person who raised objections was a white Canadian pastor, Reverend Robert Stewart MacArthur, who everyone after assumed was a black Baptist minister because he was a Baptist minister and he objected to the exhibit, so they just gave him to my people. But but he was actually the pastor of a very prominent church on West 57th Street, right across from Carnegie Hall. He, during his lifetime, was quite prominent, had been an advisor to presidents, was offered, you know, a presidential appointment. He ministered to black and whites in New York City. His congregation included the Colgate family. So he was a very, very prominent man in his time, and I think it's because of his objections that the protests were considered seriously to begin with. I think if it had only been black ministers, it probably would have been just swept aside. Did I answer your question?
The other part was there any comment in the black press?
Yes, there was some comment in the black press, but the episode was chronicled daily by the mainstream media. It was just sensational, just headlines like pretty much on a daily basis across the country. And most of them were, you know, kind of frolicking and like, you know, people reveled in the exhibit. And I should say that the one paper in this city that objected was William Randolph Hearst's journal. Called it a disgusting spectacle, a disgrace. He stood alone in objecting to it among the men of the press. Yes.
So he was...
Did everyone hear the question? What was going on with Odabanga in the years prior to his suicide? So he spent the last 6 years of his life in Lynchburg, and he initially attended classes at the seminary, and he then, you know, kind of took on odd jobs, and he was a beloved figure in the community. He was embraced by one family that took him in, and her children, he became like a father figure too. He would take children to the forest to show them the ways of a hunter. He would reenact a ritual from his time in the Congo. He would dance around a fire, chanting and singing. And he, as I said, was a beloved figure, but he did long to go home. He wanted to go home. Yes? No, I could not find anything. It doesn't mean she never did, but I did look and look and look. Unfortunately, most of her papers from that period were destroyed. Her papers, which are now at the University of Virginia, they start in like the 20s. Oda Benga died in 1916. Was there a question over here? Yes. Okay. If someone had raised the money, it would have been quite costly, and there was a world war going on, and it would have made it even more difficult. And also, just the fact that to go to the Congo, you really needed the consent of King Leopold. You couldn't just, like, show up in the Congo. They had a few things to hide. Yes.
Hi.
I just realized who you were. Sorry. It's so nice. You know, I teach, and when I see my former students and my young people, I'm like, yay.
A lot of times they say that the characters live with you. Are they in your head? Are there any parts of the story or his character that you either slept a lot with or woke up thinking about?
Oh. I mean, yeah. I thought of him every day. I probably still do. Yeah, I cried a lot in this building while writing. You're about to make me cry now. Is that what you wanted to do? Yeah, I mean, yeah, you can't live with someone for 4 or 5 years and not be affected by the memory of the person. Yes. Right.
We considered all sorts of people.
Right. And I think
all of us in this room would probably be horrified.
Right.
And this story is horrifying. But to expand it, not to take anything away from the terrible effect it has in terms of being a black person, I think America generally, we weren't nice to ladies.
Okay. Did everyone hear her comment that this was a period of sideshows, and actually human zoos even were quite popular throughout Europe. You know, so-called primitive people were paraded down boulevards all over the world. The difference I would make in this as opposed to sideshows is that Oda Benga was held against his will. He was captured by force. He was brought to this country, and he was not exhibited in a human zoo. He was exhibited with apes in a monkey house. So the suggestion was that he was not human, because if fully human, why would he be exhibited with an orangutan in a monkey house? Why would William Hornaday litter his cage with bones to suggest cannibalism? So this went beyond the whole idea of sideshows, where most of those people were complicit in some way, unless we find out that they were enslaved. Most of them were paid something. Oda Benga was not the least bit complicit in his exhibition. And there are clear signs of his resistance. He would fight, kick, bite, do anything he could not to be put back on display in the monkey house. So that is a major distinction that I draw. You want me to tell you the... A lot happened. He lived with a family in a house, in a bed. He was treated as a beloved member of the community. Yeah. Yeah, there are bright spots in this story, thank goodness. Yes.
Money from this terrible incident.
Well, the zoo attendance doubled during the 1 month that Otobanga was on display. And there were even times they wouldn't exhibit him because there were days when the zoo was free, and so they said, you know, that would be a waste. So he was exhibited during the days when people had to pay to see him. So I would say that's one institution that profited from his exhibition. But Samuel Verner also hoped to make his way as a lecturer with Otobanga as an example of the kind of savagery that he said that he represented. Yeah. Yes, in the back. Which community? Yes, because they were part of the efforts to free him from the zoo.
And was this a mixed-race community?
Well, he was embraced by the African-American community in Lynchburg. Lynchburg, as you can well imagine, was quite segregated in 1906, as was New York, but Lynchburg was even more so. Yes. Well, yeah, there were reports of his deepening depression, his desire to go home. Yeah, he was described by many people before that period as pretty happy-go-lucky, as kind of a, you know, person who just enjoyed life. His people are known for celebrating nature, the sun, you know, the forest, and he seemed to be a person who did that during his lifetime. But in the months leading up to his death, people did talk about his deepening depression. Yes. An imperial city, yes.
And the almost heady sense that the, in a sense, the elite of New York, very substantive people,
right,
in their own professions, established, and the kind of bonding that there was among that group. I thought this was a wonderful context for seeing how
Right. And one of the people, as you know, it sounds like you read the book. So thank you. So one of yes. Right. Well, the eugenics movement, as many of you know, was huge, and it was really big in New York City. It was based in Cold Springs, upstate New York. And one of the people who figures prominently in this book is Henry Fairfield Osborne, who was one of the founders of the Bronx Zoo, who was largely credited for helping to raise the money. Like, he played a lead role in establishing the zoo, who was related to J.P. Morgan, whose father was a railroad baron, and who went on after the zoo, he went on to become the president of the American Museum of Natural History for 25 years. And it was there that he held many of the Eugenics Society meetings. He was a member of the Eugenics Society. So the other person who figures prominently in the book is Madison Grant, who was the Zoological Society secretary and who went on to write a book that Hitler considered his Bible. And it was a book about how to rid this country of undesirable races, including Jews and blacks and feeble-minded and so forth and so on. But that was, you know, part of the eugenics society thinking that was pretty prevalent during this time and that remained prevalent until maybe like the 1920s. Yes. I wish they would. Has the Bronx Zoo made a statement about this episode? No. The last thing that I've seen that they've written about the Bronx, about Oda Benga was that 1974 account when they said it's unlikely it occurred. I thank the Bronx Zoo for letting me, allowing me into their archives. Without their archives, there would be no book. So I am grateful to them. I don't know if they're grateful to me, but I'm yes. No, because my book is historical. It ends in 1916. There's really no, unless you were around in 1916, I didn't really need to talk to you. I dealt with archival evidence, primary documents, for the most part. There was one woman, which goes back to the question of how I ended up writing this book. There was a woman, a poet in Lynchburg, whose family actually took Oda Benga in when she was a child, and my agent represented her. And she was trying to get her to write a book about Oda Benga, you know, and her recollections. And she eventually wrote a book-length poem about Oda Benga, but she never went back and did the research. But she was up in years, and she has since passed on. But her recollections helped me as well. I use some of them in the book. Yes. Yes, it was a citywide sensation. Zoo attendance doubled. Tens of thousands of people went to the zoo to see him. Most people were pretty much supportive of it, and there were a handful of people who protested. One of them being the pastor who I mentioned. There were another John McColland, who was a businessman in the city. He helped fund the legal case, and then the black ministers were against it, but otherwise it was pretty much accepted and viewed as, they first went to try to meet with the mayor, and then they tried to meet with Zoological Society officials. They made statements to the press. They galvanized protests by ministers outside the city. The National Baptist Convention were among the groups that issued statements about it. So, yeah, there were protests. Yes. Well, there were actually letters written to him in his native tongue by Samuel Verner, which I did have translated. Yeah. He was a missionary in the Congo years before. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, the monkey house has rooms. You know, when you can't see the animals on display, they go into these back rooms. That's where he stayed. He lived in the monkey house. And as Hornaday said, he had the best room in the monkey house. I know. Everyone's like, no, this can't be. Yes.
Yeah. Right. I mean, this was just a few decades after slavery had been abolished, right? So we already know the status of African Americans was never great. But there were signs that, you know, things were changing, and there was Reconstruction, and then there was the backlash to Reconstruction. And then, you know, you had the epidemic of lynchings, you know, throughout the 1900s. But for some, Benga's exhibition marked an implausible new low in the status of African Americans in New York City, if not in the country. Yes. No, he did learn English. Yeah, I mean, by the time he died, he had lived here for more than 10 years. Mm-hmm. And even when he was at the zoo, they said he knew like 100 English words at that time. And it's funny because I try not to read reviews because they're so upsetting. But one in the New Yorker said the last line was, you know, unfortunately, he didn't have any papers. You know, unfortunately, he didn't have any papers. And I'm like, really? That's what's unfortunate? You read my book and that's your takeaway? But there's one chapter where it's true. His, you know, I had to find him in the margins of history, right? I had to find him in the discarded, you know, papers, in between the lines. I mean, that's how I had to find him. But there's one chapter where he only utters 4 words, and those words were, "Me no like America." And that ripped my heart out because, I mean, that may not be enough for some to indicate, you know, what he was thinking, what he was feeling, if you couldn't gauge that by how he looked, how sullen and somber, sad. If you couldn't get it from that, me no like America should help you a little bit more. Right? Yeah. Yes. How has writing this book affected my views? And I'll amend it on race today. Yeah. Not much, actually. You know, I think what it did is it illuminated the heroic acts of a few who made a difference in this marginalized person's life, right? And that is typically how it goes, right? There are these heroes who defy the conventions of their time to do what's right against everything that society is telling them about this person's humanity or lack thereof. There were people who said, no, this is wrong. He's a person, he's a human. So I found that inspiring. So while many will, of course, focus on the dark side that is always with us, right? There's always the light and the possibility in all of us to be the one that says no. Thank you.